Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit subscribe. Don't forget to hit that notification bell so you're alerted whenever we go live. We will not be going into the champagne room tonight, as we had to pre-record this episode because of international timing issues with our guest, but we are very excited to have her back on the show. She was on the show a few weeks back. I wasn't on that episode, so I'm excited to be on this one. Also, if you have the means, you feel so inclined, become a patron for as little as $3 a month, $30 for the year. You can have access to champagne rooms past and present. You can be in the live audience for the Pascal Robert Mau Mau Hour. And you can also join us for our movie nights that we do usually once a month. I think we're going to have two in July. Not sure exactly yet, but we are working on that. Also, thank you to all the current patrons and current subscribers via YouTube and all the other audio podcast formats. Thank you so much. You are the fuel in the engine of the TIR machine. Speaking of the TIR machine, I have a person I have not shared the screen with in forever on the show. He is a part of the very deep bench, as people like to call it here at TIR. He is everyone's favorite history professor at Missouri State, and I'm just going to say it right now, he's the John Madden of Marxism. Please welcome Mean Gene Bajlan.
Hi, Jason. Super excited to be on the show. I was actually on with you not so long ago. If you've already forgotten Rhodesian liberation, Gene.
What were we talking about?
We were talking about that song we discovered, Rhodesia, A Country Denied, where they tried to...
Was it Pascal on that show too?
No, it was you and Taylor. And they had that song, Rhodesia Denied, where it was like they were trying to make the quote unquote woke version of defending the Rhodesian white people, which was like probably the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Would that be Land Back Back?
Yeah, Land Back.
What would that be?
Land Back Back.
Land Back.
We
back.
Want the land we stole.
We want the back. We want the land you took back, back.
Yeah, Land Back Back. Yeah.
Back. But you weren't on that show. You like bum rushed the show.
I did. I was like, welcome to. I'm from Rhodesia, and we had a lot of good things in Rhodesia. We had trains that worked. We had railways. We had a lot of interaction. And we were fighting a decolonial battle. The unilateral declaration of independence was the Rhodesian people taking their power into their own hands. That's Rhodesian Gene, my evil alter.
Our guest, we can see the guest in the virtual green room, and she's like, I can't believe this is the show I was on. They were just so serious last time. And now,
well, we reel them in with seriousness.
And then, bam, you get racism, Dawn.
There we go.
Like, she has no idea the racism that she's about to face today.
Well, let's get cracking, because it's a super exciting and important topic that we're going to be tackling today, because I think this is a debate we're having here in the United States, and, you know, the example from Thailand we're going to be discussing today, I think... Like, obviously, the context is really different, but, you know, this discussion of the sex industry, legalization, decriminalization, what are the differences between those things? Those things are relevant to the discussions we're having in America today about the sex industry and what's happening with it. So I'm really looking forward to this this discussion.
You know, in a country like Thailand, where a major part of the GDP is its illegal but well-known sexual tourism industry, is legalizing the answer to cutting down on the sex trafficking and actual sex with underage children? If Thailand legalizes one of the most well-known red light districts in the world, would this cut down on the violence that many in the industry face and be a win for labor rights for the people within the industry? Or does it just make the state the pimp? We have investigative journalist Neha Wadkar. I hope I said her name right. She recently wrote an article about Thailand for Foreign Policy titled, Thailand is the Global Capital of Illegal Sex Work. Also, wherever you're listening or watching the show, there will be a link in the description to the article. Despite earning billions annually, the industry is effectively illegal, controversial among Thais, and highly stigmatized. Now, the debate over sex work is spilling into public forums, with a progressive lawmaker introducing a bill in parliament to legalize it. Its proponents argue that criminalization has deprived sex workers of basic labor rights and protections enjoyed by other workers, making them more vulnerable to health risks, harassment, exploitation, violence, while making sex work itself no less visible. Visiting Thailand and not noticing any sex workers, it's like going to KFC and you never see fried chicken, I said. The majority of sex workers in the world are women, and a 2017 projection by the Thai Department of Disease Control conservatively estimated that 129,000 of the 144,000 sex workers in the country are female. But it's men who make the decisions about what they can do with their bodies. Women held 16% of Thailand's parliamentary seats in 2021, the same figure as 10 years ago. By comparison, women made up 20% of Saudi Arabia's governing assembly and 28% of the U.S. Congress that year. The fight for legalization is an uphill battle. Conservative factions within the country and global anti-trafficking organizations remain strongly opposed to sex work. The U.S. Agency for International Development calls Thailand a source, transit, and destination country for trafficking. And opponents of the bill say the sex industry enables widespread abuse of women and children across the country and neighboring Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. That is from journalist Neha Wadkar. Please welcome Neha.
Hi, welcome. Guys. Thank you.
Neha, gotcha.
Yeah. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for returning. Gene didn't warn you. I know that. This will be it's still a very serious topic.
I mean, last time I had Ryan Grimm to protect me, so now I'm solo.
I want you to say that out loud.
Yeah. Last time I had.
Is he a Ryan Eastwood? Grimm? Protector, yeah. Or a Kevin Costner protector?
Oh, God.
A combination of the both.
Yeah. He leans Clint Eastwood. Harrison Ford. Oh, he's gonna kill me.
Well, if we get a message for Ryan Grimm that, we'll, yeah, know that he saw the show, but that should be his new Twitter handle, right? The Clint Eastwood of journalism.
The real Clint Eastwood.
The real Clint Eastwood. Yeah, exactly.
So let's cut right to the chase. What did you see when you went to Thailand, a country that is known for its sex trade? What models are they looking at for legalization? The Nordic model or something new? And is there a push by the pimps who run the brothels to keep the sex trade in the shadows? Is there a push by law enforcement even? Because we all understand that there's cuts that they're getting off the top. Is there people within parliament and certain municipalities that want to keep this illegal because maybe they have vested interest in this? What did you see when you were there?
Yeah. Well, just kind of starting with what I saw on the ground. I mean, I was visiting two places, Bangkok and Pattaya City. Pattaya City is known for its sex work. It is a party city. You know, walking down the street, you see people from all over the world, men and women. But, you know, a lot of people from India, China, Russia, you know, generally older men, some who have gone there to retire, for example, others who are just visiting on vacation. And, you know, like the way that we started the article was, you know, it screams, the red light district screams of sex. There is sex everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, you walk down the street, and you have young women standing outside of massage parlors. They're standing outside of bars. They're just basically standing on the street. It's everywhere and in a lot of different forms. So, you know, you can go into a bar and meet a young woman and spend time with her, just hanging out, drinking beers. She's keeping you company. You know, you can get a massage, you can get a massage plus, and, you know, all the way down the line. At night, these places just blow up. So it goes from kind of seedy, kind of weird during the day, these red light districts. And then at night, it's like crazy. I mean, it's like baby Vegas. You know, there's neon everywhere. There's girls dancing in the windows. There's bouncers outside kind of keeping everyone out, who hasn't paid or hasn't put in their dues to get in. The streets are packed and it's just, you know, it's like entertainment all the time. Crazy, crazy, crazy. And you know, that's what you see in these major cities. Obviously I didn't travel all over Thailand, so I can't speak to the more beautiful kind of tourist beach resort places, right? But this is Bangkok and Pattaya. And then, you know, you asked, is there, what model are they thinking about, right? So as of now, sex work is effectively illegal, which is crazy because, you know, if you watch Hollywood movies, right, everyone says they're going to Thailand for a holiday on their bachelor party. And, you know, it's kind of got this reputation of being a place for sex work.
Not to interrupt your flow, no, but when you were there, I'm assuming you're seeing a lot of, I don't want to say Westerners, because you probably have people also from the East that are going there, you're closer. So could you see, you know, Anglos walking around trying to buy sex?
Yeah, 100%.
Is that what you mostly saw?
I would say there was a fair amount of that. I was also, you know, there were a lot of Russians. There were a lot of, and that, this is just based on what I saw, what languages I was hearing, and what people told me, right? So there were a lot of Russian men. There were a lot of Indian men, and there were a lot of Chinese men. So I would say the majority of the people I saw were from Western countries or appeared to be from Western countries. There were Americans, there were Europeans, you know, maybe other places as well. But you really, it was like one of the creepy things, right? Is like, like sex really, it doesn't matter what race you are and what color you are and where you're from. Like everybody wants sex and everybody was there looking for sex. I think that was like one of the weird things that I hadn't expected before.
You didn't think they were looking for Pad Thai or?
No, they were not looking for Pad Thai. I mean, there were people there with their families. Like there were I saw men there with their wives. There were a lot of Indian couples who came, like the guy and the wife, and like the wives were like really just not looking happy. Like they looked uncomfortable and they were kind of walking around the street. It must've been some, like they said, okay, either I'll come with you or you go alone. And they decided coming with was better. I don't know. There were also people there with their kids and I guess their kids would probably play in the sand and be at the beach all day. And then like at night they would, you know, keep them in the hotel and the parents would go out or whatever. It's weird. It's strange dynamics, going on there.
That's interesting. So yeah. Does it feel safe?
It does feel safe. It did feel safe. There's so many people there and it feels like this is such a big part of the economy, whether it's documented or not. That it is, you know, I felt very comfortable walking down the street. I also felt as a young woman that there was no confusion about who I was and what I was doing there. Nobody was propositioning me for sex. But you know, there was a very clear purpose to everyone being there. And there were women there too, who were
you
going
trying to dress like a tourist. So there was no chance.
I was trying to dress like a nun.
You just baggy cargo.
But there were women there as well.
There were, and actually people that I interviewed said that there are women who come in to meet with women, and there are also male prostitutes, male sex workers, and that is a big part of this as well. Mm-hmm. There's people known as lady boys, which are, you know, men who are dressed as women, but there's also homosexual sex workers, and there are male sex workers who serve female clients. So it's really whatever is on the menu that tickles your fancy, you can find.
Yeah, I mean, there was a documentary that came out a few years ago about sex work in various countries. It was Mexico, Thailand, and somewhere else. I think Eastern Europe. And I remember when they were showing Thailand that there was an after-hour spot that the women that worked at these places would go when they got off, where ostensibly they were paying for men's company.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of interesting. I was like, oh, that's weird.
Yeah, okay. It's kind of, it has this weird feeling of like anything goes, like whatever your preference is. I mean, and I didn't dive into the dark stuff. I mean, I you know, this is, on the face of it, this is consensual sex between two adults, right? There's a whole different host of issues around trafficking, around child sex that we'll probably end up talking about. But this is, you know, when it comes to consensual adult sex, it's kind of, people can get really creative, and there's, doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of judgment as to what you want being available for you.
The conservative argument generally is, you know, one that it's a slippery slope. And, you know, once you allow this, then the next thing you know, they're going to be banging your toddler. So being that you were walking around somewhere where it's pretty much all out in the open, I mean, there's literal YouTube channels that teach you how to navigate in the cities that you were in, how to properly ask for extras. Did you see any children out in the open?
No, I didn't. But I did. I was working with a very talented videographer who had done work on stories about underage sex trafficking, and he had seen that himself. So it is there for sure. I didn't see it, but I also don't know if I'd know what to look for, right? It's really hard to know people's age. You know, a lot of these, you know, over 18 sex workers look really young, and they intentionally look young, right? They're trying to feed a certain thirst for, you know, I guess young flesh. And so they dress a certain way and they look a certain way. And I think that's really tough. Then it also makes it more difficult for police and even clients, if you think about it, to really know. They might say, I want someone who looks young, with the intention that they would get an 18-year-old who looks like a 15-year-old, but actually what they're really getting is a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old, which is horrible, right? I mean, it's just, but it is very tricky. And that's one of the arguments that people make when they're talking about legalization, because once you legalize, you regulate, and you have IDs, and you have age limits, you have hiring requirements, you have databases, and all of those things then provide an extra layer of protection for kids who are obviously not going to be able to be accredited or registered because they're underage, and someone would catch them in that process.
What do you say then to people that are against that model that say, again, maybe more of a conservative argument that would say, well, you can go to any strip club in America where it's regulated and legal, and you can always find an underage young woman in there?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think with something like this, it kind of comes down to a harm reduction model, right? As a sort of traditional public health framework. And, you know, the idea is we're never going to eliminate this entirely, because people are people and you can't control everything. So when you're in a situation where you can put in certain measures and safety guidelines in place to minimize the harm, isn't that what we're targeting for? I mean, you're, show me a solution where you're going to manage to get every single underage person out of the sex industry. If the argument is by making it criminal and illegal and banning it completely, you're going to get everybody out. No, you're not. All you're going to do is push that industry underground. That means there's fewer protections for those people. The only way to get rid of the sex industry entirely is to get rid of men and women's desire to have sex. And I don't know how you would do that.
Well, divorce. what I wanted to tease out then is, you know, in your article, you mentioned there are different approaches to this. There's a question of decriminalization, and there's the question of legalization. And then there are, of course, people who are opposed to any kind of concession towards the sex industry, which includes, as you mentioned in the article, a kind of strange but understandable alliance between a certain a tranche of feminists and a certain, you know, Christian conservative moralistic element. Can you pass out the difference then between, you know, in the article, I think a lot of the people in the sex industry, and I don't know if they were sex workers or pimps within the industry, but they favor more of a decriminalization model, where there is this other model of legalization which is a slightly different. So can you explain to people who don't might not understand what the differences between those two approaches are, what they mean in practice?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, and this was actually the part where I learned a lot, because I didn't realize how much nuance there was between these different models. And I think that's really important. You've got a full legalization model, right? And what that means is the industry is legal, it is taxed, and it is regulated. That means it is the same as legalizing marijuana or legalizing alcohol or legalizing cigarettes, right? The government is able to put certain restrictions around it. So for example, an 18 plus rule. And they're also benefiting from it tax-wise. They're actually getting money from this industry. The decriminalization model is something that like Americans, for example, might be familiar with this because it was the in-between that we were seeing when it came to legalizing marijuana, right? There was this idea that if you get caught doing this, it's not going to be a felony. It's not going to be a criminal offense. And it's something there where a lot of kind of look the other ways on this. Decriminalization means that women are probably far less likely to get picked up by the police and actually held and charged with a crime, as opposed to maybe just a simple kind of telling off or, you know, make sure you take this down the block. The reason that decriminalization is favored by a lot of sex workers, and this was something that I found really interesting, is they don't necessarily want to be regulated the way that a legalization model would regulate them, right? They don't necessarily want to have specifics about where are you able to work? What zones can you work in? What, you know, how do you submit and become members of this particular organization that is going to allow you to practice openly, right? There's going to be rules around registration, around where you can work, when you can work, with whom you can work. Do you have to wear contraception? There are all of these different kind of rules that legalization would create. And some of those are barriers to entry for freelance sex workers. So you've got sex workers who might be working through a bar, through a madam or a pimp. Those people are kind of part of almost a bigger organization. They've got backing behind them. They have pooled resources and they have someone kind of overseeing their welfare, if you will. Whether that's done properly or not is a different story. Decriminalization, if you're a freelance sex worker, so if you go out on the street and you get your business by standing on a street corner and working for yourself, or if you have an online profile and you get your business through TikTok or Facebook, you know, you're basically working alone. And so in order to register, let's say, and pay an annual fee to be a sex worker, which is one of the things that might happen under a legalization model, you're going to have a really high barrier to entry. You may not be able to afford that. You may not be able to afford to pay for an annual license. Decriminalization means you don't have to do any of that stuff, but you're not going to get busted. Criminalization, which is most of the world's model at the moment, is this isn't completely illegal. So it shames the sex workers. Usually it means that the sex workers, not their clients, are the ones who are getting arrested, fined, put into jail, bribed by the police, you know, threatened. And in the cases where they face violence, which is very often, they are not able to go to the police. If some guy, you know, slashes them with a knife or rapes them, they can't go to the police because they're afraid that they're going to get arrested. So that's the third model.
So it's very interesting your explanation of legalization, because it seems that, you know, for large businesses that profit off sex works, let's call it Big Pimp, right? Mm-hmm. Big Pimp would certainly benefit from this because they'll be able to monopolize access to sex work. So I could certainly see that this would create kind of a two-tiered system, because if you're a poor person who's working by themselves, you're going to suffer the same like legal regime that you had under a criminalization regime, because you're not going to be able to do it. So basically it basically institutionalizes the role of pimp businesses, right?
Well, let me ask this. So you're basically saying, Gene, what happens when the Walmart of pimping comes in?
We've seen this in Germany. I mean, in Germany with these giant factory brothels that they have, there. I mean, it solves perhaps one set of problems, but it doesn't solve the issue of the most vulnerable people who are being forced into sex work.
That's why I wanted to ask, what model are they looking at? Are they kind of looking at the Nordic model, which seems to be kind of the go-to model for so many people that are thinking about legalizing? Or are they looking at something like New Zealand and Australia, which I don't really hear a lot of people talking about when they talk about decriminalization, which they've across the board decriminalized everything down to street walking. Street mm-hmm. prostitution is legal there. The only real barrier, I would say, is that you have to be a citizen. You can't be there on a visa. That, of course, hasn't stopped people from working on visas.
I think you also have to wear a condom.
Yeah.
I think that might be another, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is great.
I don't know how you regulate that.
No, but at least it gives people, you know, this kind of, no, it's the law, we have to. And then if someone says no, it gives them a little bit of juice to be able to walk away from that situation.
I mean, it's an interesting, I was doing some reading. I read up on that model a few years back, mm-hmm. and to prep for this show, I actually did more reading, and I was shocked at the amount of academic papers that are written on that model in particular. And it does seem like the regulatory bodies within New Zealand, especially, do come from the pimping world. So their look at it is definitely going to be very different. Regulation. The last study I read there was from, I think, 2019, 2020. Mm-hmm. And I think they had inspected 22 out of like over 1,000 brothels in 12 years time. So again, you know, regulation and how we want to look at regulation is going to vary. I don't think New Zealand's sex trade was ever to the level of Thailand. Those places really aren't that far apart. But what I did find was that the majority of the women within the trade were from the Maori ethnic group, which, if you know anything about New Zealand, they're the native people of that area. And there's definitely almost a caste system there when it comes to that. So in Thailand, as far as the women working within the industry, what was kind of the makeup? Was there a class makeup of these women?
It was really interesting, actually. You've got people from all over. I would say that I did not meet any people who were middle upper class from Bangkok, certainly not. But I did meet women from all across Thailand. There were people from urban areas, there were people from rural areas. There are a lot of migrants from Laos, Cambodia, and Myanmar who are working there as well. Some of them who came over eyes open, knowing what they were coming over for, and some of them who came over thinking that they would work in a restaurant or they would work as a bar hostess, which is, I think, one of the things that is often advertised, right? Come and work in this bar, or come and be a waitress and a server. And this is just something that automatically gets added on. So Anna, the transgender sex worker that I interviewed as kind of one of the main voices in the story, she was originally from, you know, a smaller kind of town. She was working in a factory. She was making pennies, per month. And then she always wanted to be a cabaret dancer. So she moved with the idea that she would get a waitressing job as she made it big, you know, singing and dancing, which, think about like how many people we know who have that story in New York and in London and in Broadway. You know, it's a very, very typical story. So that's what she did. And, you know, the first client that she ended up getting asked her, she did a massage for that person. And they basically said, you know, I'll give you the same amount that she was making in a month in her factory. He said, I'll give you that much if you give me a happy ending, basically. And she did. And she was like, it was awesome. I got a ton of money from that. Mm-hmm. She was really interesting because she was very, she was brave. And I think she always puts things in brave terms, but she was empowered. And she talked about, being with a client, for example, and saying, I was like, what do you do when you get with a client? She's like, the first thing I do is I turn on my timer, you know, like she was really funny. And like, she's like, even if you want to sit and talk and get to know each other, well, that's your problem. Cause the timer's running. Time is money, you know? So like she really had taken this job, and you know, she was freelance. She had taken this job and she had made it her own, and you know, she felt empowered. She's sending money back to her family every month. She lives in, I saw her place. She lives in a nice, you know, one bedroom apartment with a balcony and a nice kitchen. And, you know, she's doing well. And I think, you know, she would be an example of someone who has successfully made it in the industry. She's older now too. She's really kind of thinking, okay, what am I going to do next? As opposed to, you know, there were some women that I saw who looked really young, you know, alarmingly young. There were women who looked really high, you know, who looked pretty out of it, and who knows really what they were on or what they've been given. You know, and there were also, there's a really interesting kind of ethnic racial thing going on where there are different clubs owned by different people, and the Russians own a bunch of clubs, and you know, they have those signs outside that say like Russian girls, like girls, 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 you know, with the, and that is, those women are considered to be like a specialty. They are the most expensive. They have the highest prices. They are the most guarded of women. I think most of them do know what they're coming over here for, according to some of the people I spoke with, and some of them don't, obviously. And that is sex trafficking. But there's that, then, you know, you have, there was a place that had Bollywood women. There was a place that had Thai women. There's a place that had, you know, there were all of these different racial and ethnic kind of specialties. If you walked around, you could kind of find what suited your fancy. So that's another weird layer.
So it's like an international layer. It's really an international sex center. I mean, it's not just, you know, it's got to such a level that it's not just, I mean, you chart in the article, you chart out the history of the sex industry, the Japanese occupation, the Chinese you know, when you have a lot of immigrant labor, this is very common. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons for the big issue in Australia with the sex industry was because of the mining, the mining boom. You had this huge, I mean, the women there are making something like, you know, $750,000 a year. In that mining industry. But yes, so you have this huge, like, predominantly male immigrant labor, Chinese labor, and it kind of sort of feeds back. But the kind of image you're painting now, it's like, it's not just like, I don't know, like Vietnam or Cambodia, which have sex industries. It is like a literal global center of the sex industry, which is bringing in women from, it's not just relying on the reserve army of labor in Thailand, but it's like shipping women from around the world to sort of reinforce this kind of catering.
And what then happens then? Does legalization make that when you're there and you're seeing this, you know, Epcot center of sex?
That's a good way to put it.
That's the word.
And that's what it looks like.
Yeah, the little passport stamped, like like you're in Disneyland. Look, Dad. What then? Because this is an interesting thing. Because, you know, there's probably certain countries that don't want to be tied to this.
I mean, I don't think Thailand wants to be tied to this. There was a report that came out a couple days after we got back, and it was a raid that had taken place in Pattaya City, where we were. And the police were like, don't worry, there's no sex workers here. And it was like, people thought it was hilarious because it's like, you got photos of the chief of police with like girls standing behind him. And he's like, don't worry, all clear. There's no sex workers here. So I think that for Thailand itself, which is historically a, you know, a socially conservative country, right? You've got people who have a lot of pride in being Thai and the history of Thailand. And for them, it's like, we don't want to be known as this, you know, sex trafficking and sex work hub. Like, that is not the reputation we want. And so you've got a very strong sector of the population that is fighting back against this reputation because they don't want to be known for this. They're happy to be known for their amazing food and their beautiful beaches. And, you know, for them, there would still be a lot of tourism coming into the country because Thailand is gorgeous. I mean, if you ever get a chance to go, I highly recommend it. It was stunning. But, you know, there's this additional layer of, and it's really hard to know how many of the tourists coming in to visit Thailand are coming in strictly for sex. It's almost impossible to know that because there's no numbers, there's no stats.
Gene, do you have a follow-up?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, from reading your article, like this progressive lawmaker is pushing forward this, I would say, a legalization regime, some form of legalization regime. Is there, you know, you noted, of course, you know, that there's a sort of a conservative, and I would say also like perhaps nationalist reaction against this reputation as a sex hub, you know. Very masculine patriots do not like to see their country, their women folk being defiled by the foreigner. But do you think as the sex, and, you know, one of the things that I found interesting in the article was about the impact of COVID on these places and how this stuff shut down. Now, I'm assuming that this, you know, the COVID crisis laid bare how important the sex industry is to the Thai economy. Is there, do you think there's a sort of connection here that, you know, that the government wants a cut of this money that's flowing into the country, and whatever their kind of, let's say, emotional feelings about sex work is, there's so much, so many groups invested in this, so much money to be made. It's so critical to the economy that, you know, legalization may come simply because they want to cut up that money. People have become pragmatic. They may not like it, but they're like, well, if we're going to have it, the state is going to get its cut of the money. Has this been facilitated by that kind of COVID crisis? What's the context for this push for a kind of legal regime to regulate prostitution? Because I am very skeptical that it's all just like, oh, we care about the working girls, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good question. So we interviewed a politician from the Move Forward Party, which is a progressive party. Actually, today they are trying to coalesce a government. It's for the first time in, I believe, 10 years that there's going to be a new government that's going to be formed under the current king. And the Move Forward Party, as of when I checked yesterday, is looking pretty good. So I don't know, you know, what the outcome of that is, but it'll be really interesting to see if they end up taking power in parliament. Because, you know, when I first heard about this, I was like, Move Forward Party, like this must be some, you know, fringe group that's, you know, supporting, you know, social issues that people are generally opposed to. But they're a legit political group. And the person that we spoke with used to be a dancer and now is a progressive politician. And they care a lot about social issues. They are very pro-LGBTQ. They are pro-trans rights. And they are pro-sex worker. And this is a situation where it does fit into their political agenda. And they do care about the fate of sex workers, because I think they know a lot of sex workers within the people who make up the party itself. But we did ask questions about, okay, so you've got, you know, you got this huge industry, and how exactly are you going to do this? And they have actually outlined all of this in a bill that they want to put forward in the new parliament. So the whole thing is, okay, let's wait to see how the chips fall on forming this new parliament, and then we'll decide if it makes sense to put this legislation forward. If it passes, though, they want to tax the industry. And I asked kind of, where is this tax money going to go? And the politician who was supporting the bill said, you know, one of the places I'd like it to go to is education, because if we have kids who are educated, there's a much stronger chance that they're not going to follow their parents down the same path of using sex work as a way to make money. So he sort of saw this kind of full circle thing where he thought, okay, we're going to put some of the money back into the schools, because that's going to be, that's a worthy place to put that tax money. Knowing the way that politics works, and in a lot of these countries that that I report in, there's issues of corruption that run from the top all the way down. As of now, the police are getting a pretty hefty cut of money. This is like widely known, widely reported, widely talked about. I mean, they, especially the local police, my understanding is that the national police are a bit more kind of with it in terms of the agenda of cracking down on sex work, but not profiting from it. But the local police especially are making a hell of a lot of money busting up sex workers and pimps who don't pay. And, you know, allowing the ones who do give a cut to then continue their work. So, you know, there's always that component of the government wanting to keep things illegal because they're actually benefiting from bribes. And that's something that we heard over and over and over again from sex workers is they are getting bribed by the police. You know, if, and we spoke to somebody pretty high up in the police service, and that person told us, you know, I would actually be kind of relieved if it got legalized, because then my guys can work on something else. They're not just going up and down and busting prostitutes all day. They are, you know, able to move aside from that and actually start spending their time and energy on something that matters, but, is the way he said it.
That's interesting. Cause I remember reading that in the piece.
Yeah.
And I thought about the fact that how much of what they do revolves around this massive industry. Mm. You know, if you're saying that you're seeing people obviously intoxicated in some way, shape or form, that definitely means that you have, you know, issues with drugs. If you have if I'm a drug dealer and I have a market right here of customers, it's probably worth a lot of money. That means there's probably a lot of violence within that industry as well. Are the people that are in the legalization regime, you know, also looking at that, or is that something that's so outside of the realm because people understand the importance of this industry that, that the police just crack down on that so hard?
I think, like, I think what this guy was saying is, like, you know, if we have to stop just busting women who are standing on a street corner for doing nothing, right? Yeah. That's where we're spending our time, is we're like, huh, you're wearing a short skirt and you're standing outside a bar, like, we're gonna pick you up and take you in. I think what his, what he was trying to communicate is, if we don't have to spend our time doing that, we can crack down on the drug dealers, and we can crack down on the sex trafficking, and we can track down on the kiddie stuff, which is obviously a huge issue and the most disturbing part of all of this. Right. And I think that was his argument, is this frees us up from doing, you know, these kind of petty busts that don't really make any difference, to being able to actually focus our time and resources on the more important crimes that are being committed, and focusing on the you know, the kingpins or the drug dealers or the, you know, the trafficking rings, as opposed to the girl who's standing on the corner, right? It's kind of, and, you know, this was a police representative. I don't know to what extent what he was saying is necessarily going to come to pass if things are legalized, but that was what he expressed, is, you know, if there's legalization, I'm not opposed to it because it's going to actually make my job more sensible.
That's extremely interesting, because you know, that might be an outcome, but what, when you were explaining that, what came to my mind was the fact that, well, if you have a legal regime, they might end up spending their whole time policing the legal regime, you know. They'll be ended up busting, instead of busting everybody, they focus their energies on busting those who don't, those people, those freelancers, like you said, who are not conforming to the legal regime. So from, so they end up, you know, serving to consolidate prostitution into, like, big business in the country.
Right.
Like, move it away. I mean, it's a, it's an interesting dynamic, because that's why, you know, obviously when we discuss these options, you know, repression, decriminalization, and legalization, it truly is a harm reduction debate, because all these options are kind of have very terrible side effects to them.
Yeah,
they have really terrible side, you know, like, what frustrates me a lot of the time in the debate about legalization of sex work in the United States is, you know, a lot of the people are, you know, people who, like, maybe get their clothes off on OnlyFans. They don't, you know, sex work is a very, very broad term. There's a big difference between taking erotic photos of your feet and selling them, and then the, and then what, I mean, when we were discussing this off there, like, the endless brutal rape that the vast majority of sex, like, a significant majority of sex workers around the world suffer from, you know, like, yes, there are people who can, you know, like,
non-consensual
stuff. I mean, when you see those things about sex work in Thailand or in India, you know, it's like, it's just endless rape. That's what it is. It's like a rape factory. And, you know, obviously, you know, there are people who go into it with their eyes open or eyes less open. And, you know, you don't need to white knight for everybody. You know, some people might go into prostitution knowing what they're doing, right? You know, but for a lot of people, that's, they might go in, you know, just because you're selling yourself for sex doesn't mean people have free license to do what they want to you, which is what often happens to sex workers. But it does seem like every single regime, this legalization regime, does not necessarily mean that the state will leave sex workers alone. It might just end up attacking the freelancers.
It's funny you say that, Gene, because in the last thing I read before we went on air, apparently in New Zealand on their site, the regulatory board has a whole like frequently asked question thing about relaxing your anus for anal penetration. Like, hey, Christ. Guys,
just, like, how do I do it?
Yeah, like hey, like there's some complaints about this. You guys, if you just relax, then give it 20 minutes and easy peasy and moving on.
That's oh my God. Going to a government website to about how to perform a particular sex act, it's, is this like,
I mean, that could be the future. It could be dystopian, but it could be the future.
I mean, that's what, because you were talking about like, oh, I don't want to do that. Right. Like we all have anecdotal stories of what happens even in legal regimes. Like, so you have the one small county in Nevada,
right,
where it's legal at the brothel. And the man that ran it was known as kind of one of the bigger pimps in the country.
Yeah.
And was able to merchandise the hell out of it. And there is it was a news story a few years back. And I actually had a friend that was there as a bus driver for this person, but a famous rock musician was drunk off his tits, as Gene would say. And the owner said, this is guy is famous, just don't try to upcharge him. You know, everything's on the house, don't worry about it. The young lady was like, whatever, don't know him, F that guy. Tried to upcharge him, and this rock singer ended up beating her up.
Okay.
And the owner of the brothel, the rock guy's manager, tried to get him out of there. He eventually couldn't get out fast enough, and the young lady called the police, and the guy got arrested, and it was a news story for like 5 minutes. But these things do happen, because I think we're also dealing with the population kind of like how we see even like warehouse labor or fast food labor.
Yeah. You've got people who are hugely underrepresented, you know, marginalized, and, you know, the interesting question here is also about agency, right? There are women, and, you know, I saw an amazing TED talk by a woman named Juno Mack, who's written a book on this. And you know, it was, saw your note that it was Vince Neil here, so now we know. And you know, so you've got women like Juno Mack, who's done this amazing TED talk, and she talks about her decision to voluntarily get involved in sex work in the United Kingdom, right? Which is, you know, something that she chose to do for a bunch of reasons. One of them was that she was making no money, working a dead-end job, and was like, I need more than this, and decided as a young, you know, attractive woman, to do what she wanted with her body. And right. And that adds a whole different layer of complexity to it, because it's like, you know, we're talking about my body, my choice. Well, that extends across the board, right? I mean, if we're talking about what women are able to do with their bodies, if they choose to, and there are people who are like, no one woman would ever choose to do this. Well, I've met women who chose to do it, and they chose to do it, and they say they chose to do it. And, you know, they would rather do that than work in a factory and make no money. They want to support their families. In a perfect world, they wouldn't have to do it. There would be more and better job opportunities for them, but we don't live in a perfect world. And so giving them that choice also then gets into conversations about women's rights and feminism and a bodily autonomy. And that's a whole nother layer on this, right? It is a conversation about harm reduction and how to best protect women. There are massive issues of exploitation across the board of, as we've said, of sex trafficking, of underage, you know, pedophilia. But there's also a section of women who choose to do this and want to, and how do we honor that as well? I think that's a complicated question.
I think that that really gets to the heart of the question because, you know, because we have on a global level, currently a sex industry, which is based on massive exploitation. It's based on trafficking. It's based on the brutalization of women. But there are, you know, women who, and you know, sex as a sex and interpersonal relationships are a difficult thing, right? You know, what is the difference between, you know, looking for a sugar daddy and being a prostitute, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one is like, I mean, let's say one is one thing. One is like, I guess, overtly transactional. The other is kind of explicitly transactional. How do we navigate these kind of difficult lines, whether there isn't really a hard dividing line? And, you know, you have an industry where it may be the majority of people are exploited, but if people choose to go into it, like, how do you, like you said, how do you regulate a person disposing of their body in the way that they want to dispose of that body? Is there a difference between between someone marrying someone basically they don't really care about to get money and, you know, just having short-term transactional sexual relationships? Is there a moral distinction between that? Is there a practical distinction between that? What does that mean in the Middle East? You know, they have this in the Shia tradition, they have this tradition of mutta, the sira, the temporary marriage, right? Whereas you can get married for like a 24-hour period. It's religiously sanctioned, and you know, you pay the priest some money. The Shia clergy do that little bit of pimping, and the marriage is temporary, but it's sanctioned by society. So, like, societies have created legal regimes for this before, but it's such a messy topic, and there isn't a clear dividing line between, let's say, overt prostitution and then people in a society with major power imbalances, you know, having to, yeah. And it's not just women. You see all these like guys, all these the sexual capital argument, where you have all these like young men from Turkey and on from Kenya marrying like 65-year-old divorces, chubby blondes. Let's just be honest about the demographic that's doing this. Generally, chubby blondes. But you know, this is that's technically not prostitution, but it seems to be in the kind of same kind of exploitative vein as well. So it's like a very hard topic to really come to the definitive answer for, because there are, you know, you legalize it, then there's going to be exploitation. You decriminalize it, there's going to be exploitation. You ban it, and there's going to be exploitation. Mm-hmm. Just where is it going to go? And one thing you mentioned is, you know, like at the outset, is about, you know, it's one thing for the adults, but also there's the children who become involved in this. Did you know what was the discussion with the people? You know, I know you said you didn't see anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what were people saying about this particular topic?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I spoke to a guy who is, he's the head of like an anti-trafficking alliance. He's an older gentleman, you know, lives in a really nice little suburb of Bangkok, has a wife and a son, like really just, you know, kind of gives off that impression of being a very respectable guy. And he's been working in this anti-trafficking space for a long time. And, you know, for him, he has like a zero tolerance policy, because the way he sees it is if we allow some sex work to happen, we open the doors up for mass widespread exploitation. He deals with a lot of women and girls who are being trafficked from surrounding countries. And he deals with a lot of kids who are being trafficked from surrounding countries. And, you know, he has seen things that I think probably just haunt him. You know, he has... you know, the number that we saw was about 610,000 human trafficking victims in Thailand alone. And that number is probably low. You know, and that is a lot. That is a lot of it. That is.
Are they saying that's people that didn't come from Thailand into Thailand, or that's people that come from like maybe rural areas that are sent there?
It's both. Okay. It's both external and internal. People being trafficked for a lot of it is manual labor. That's why a lot of people come over. But then, you know, in those migration flows, you also have people who are being brought in for other reasons. So my understanding, I didn't get to go, but the border towns are supposed to be pretty bad. The same thing that you would see in a border town on the US and Mexico border, I would expect, you know. And so I think, you know, that component of it is people have seen some really horrible shit. And they, you know, once they've seen that, they're like, there is no gray space here. Like this is not a conversation. Like if this is what the end product is, if this is a five-year-old boy or a five-year-old girl that is being trafficked for sex, because, you know, we have these, you know, confusing kind of convoluted, maybe yes, maybe no laws. We need to ban it, and we need to crack down on it, and we need the police and we need the army going out and making sure that this isn't happening to children. That's a really understandable perspective. But I don't know if that's necessarily the perspective that reduces the maximum amount of harm. And if that's the framework you're looking at it from, you think to yourself, you know, what is going to prevent the spread of STDs and HIV? What is going to prevent unwanted pregnancies and under the table abortions? You know, what is going to allow women to keep the maximum amount of money that they make, have their own autonomy around the way they spend their time, who they stay with, who they go with, who they say no to? And also, you know, what is going to be a way to protect women from violence? I mean, you know, another one of the stats that we saw was around women who are dealing with, you know, mass levels of violence, and something I believe it was like 45 to 75% of women who are sex traffic, like who are sex workers, they have a higher chance, 45 to 75% higher chance of experiencing violence and exploitation in their work. That's huge. You know, that is crazy numbers. And, you know, to have women being forcibly raped, you know, at knife point, or being beaten up, or being, you know, all of the other terrible stuff that happens in, you know, when bedroom doors are closed. I mean, that is something that needs to be prevented, right? So it's difficult because people's emotions are high and the bad outcomes are really, really bad. But how do you figure out what to solve for? And I think that's the question that people are trying to ask and answer.
Is there a big right-wing push to keep this an illegal industry? And if so, is that right-wing push also asking for even more police and, it sounds like, military help to get rid of the current brothel situation?
Yeah, there is a right-wing push. There's, you know, there's almost, I feel like there's always a right-wing push. This is a case of like really unlikely parties coming together. There is an organic right-wing push within Thai society, which is like, you know, conservative factions, conservative politicians, some religious groups and religious leaders. You know, the country is mostly Buddhist, but they also have Christians and others. And so there are some outspoken religious leaders who are speaking out against this. So you've got those factions, and those are kind of homegrown. But my understanding, and this is interesting, when we were on the ground, I was like, I want to go interview people who are against this, you know, who are against the liberalization of sex trafficking laws. And the people I was with who are Thai were like, that's going to be really hard to find. And I was like, really? Like, if you were in the US, it would be very easy to find conservative voices to speak mm-hmm. out against an issue. And they would be very happy to speak to a journalist. And these guys were like, no, it's kind of like, it's not really like done. They don't really speak out because nobody really cares. You know, the general society, people don't go out and petition against sex workers. That actually would be quite taboo. So it's almost like the conservative perspective, although it seems like it's, you know, held by a lot of people, it is not one that's put out there and promoted the same way that, let's say, social conservatism is in the US. I thought that was really interesting. But, you know, you've got that. And then you've also got a global conservatism that is coming into play here. And what I found out from speaking to some of the academics is actually you have U.S. evangelicals and U.S. feminists in the late 1990s, early 2000s, who got together on this anti-pornography campaign. They were trying to stamp out pornography. And this is like, you know, you're kind of the predecessors to the Tea Party evangelicals combining with your, you know, what people would call your radical feminists coming together on an issue, which is really strange. And then they came together again on this anti-trafficking issue. And that global agenda, as is so commonly done in the US, that global agenda is now being, that conservative agenda is being exported now. So they're actually petitioning in other countries and interfering in other countries to impact their own sex trafficking laws, which is both surprising and not.
The international social conservative. I mean, we see this in Africa as well. Usually. With evangelicals. You know, those guys on that island had the right. What was that? What's that? The Sentinel Island guys. Whenever they see an evangelical, they know exactly what to do. Fire your bows and arrows, ask questions later. But yeah, I mean, like you have this, like, I mean, I'm in the heart of it. Like I live in Springfield and you think, oh, you know, like these hicks don't go anywhere. No, they've all been all over the world on mission.
Is it? Wow.
They've been to Africa. Mm. They've been to, I know people just randomly who've been to Iraq. Got the James River megachurch here. You know, they do, you know, like these evangelicals have a lot
missionary
of money behind
kids just
them.
Left here. We had a bunch of
they just go around the world and like, and they were a key vector for the spreading of this kind of internet, because also the internet, you have this kind of
Facebook live screams of the church sermons and
exactly. Yeah. And not just the religious right, but also when all this QAnon stuff was kicking off, one of the craziest thing is like random people I know from Hull, right, in England, were like super into like they're eating people conspiracy, because this stuff just spreads on the internet and people just pick up on it. So you have this like just global klug of right-wing religious, secular, right-wing spread through missionaries, through the internet and things like that. So I'm not, it's like not surprising. Like like we said, in Africa, like in Uganda, these evangelicals are doing all kinds of shenanigans.
Anti-LGBTQ, yeah.
So would we then see a lot of the trafficking films that were like really popular in the late aughts and early 2010s, where, you know, some woman is taken from a poor country and sent to either Thailand or Mexico or Eastern Bloc stories, especially those that happened after the 90s in the Balkans. How are the women that come out of that industry viewed by society? Because is there an underclass ideology around people that work within this industry? Like, are these kind of like, is there a scarlet letter that they
totally
wear forever?
Okay. Totally. Yeah. I mean, the social stigma is real. And the funny thing is, you know, often the people who are stigmatizing the most or raising the biggest fuss about it are clients. I mean, you know, there's so much hypocrisy in this. And yeah, women who are, you know, pushed or forced or go out of, you know, necessity, wanting to be the primary breadwinner, take care of their family, whatever the reason is that they go into sex work, once they're in it, there is that scarlet letter. And you know, the social stigma, even though it is something that is so widely accepted, you see it on the streets everywhere in Thailand. You know, it is still something that is considered taboo and something that is considered lesser than and second class. And I think part of what a lot of women are arguing for is hopefully if we make it legal, it will not be as socially stigmatized, that the kind of chicken and egg, right? It's illegal. And so these women are bad, and these women are bad because it's illegal, right? And so if you suddenly break that and you say, actually, it's not illegal, it's regulated and it's part of our industry, it's part of our economy. And this is something that people do, whether they're women or men, which in Thailand, there's a pretty diverse, sorry, my cat is interested in what we have to say. It's a little cat. But, you know, you've got this idea that by, you know, decriminalizing or legalizing, you're going to also reduce social stigma. And that's huge for these women, right? I mean, it's horrible to live your life feeling like a second class citizen or feeling like someone who is dirty or is not wanted by society or looked down on. I mean, I don't know what that feels like, but it sounds like it would really suck.
And what do they do for people that have aged out? I mean, sadly, the sex industry is...
Yeah,
I don't know. I've read Vice articles that tell you mean different things.
I would guess that there is a market for women who are like in their older years. But I would also say that, you know, some of them at that point might have kids who can then take care of them. Right. There's a very big culture of care between generations and in Asian countries, and Thailand is one of them. I also would guess that some of them become madams and start being, you know, the kind of higher up in the industry, and you know, they've gone through this own experience. They know what makes a good and a bad madam. You know, they then become the woman in charge, and they oversee their own flock of younger women who are in the industry. And you know, there are probably women who end up in really bad circumstances. You know, begging or almost begging. And you know, I don't think there's a great retirement plan for...
I was going to ask if they had a plan for any sort of pension. I mean, I'm trying to be serious. I wasn't being facetious at all. Like, is there
a plan
to actually put together some sort of pension plan? Because I'm assuming the guy paying for sex doesn't want the charge on his card.
Right. Right. I mean, and you know, first of all, there's that whole question, right? If you legalize federally... nationally, are you going to be able to pay for this on a credit card? That's we're dealing with that in the US with weed right now. Is that going to be something that becomes possible? But yeah, I mean, I think when they talk about benefits, those are some of the benefits that are being discussed, is like, can you put into a retirement plan? I mean, it sounds crazy, but also like it doesn't really, because what happens to these women? You know, if you work, let's say, manual labor, you're putting into a fund, right? And the idea is that by the time you're 45 and your back is completely shot because you've been doing this really difficult work, you have something to fall back on. And you know, I would assume that if this is fully legalized, that would be one of the things that could happen. Obviously, if it's only decriminalized, that's probably not the case. So again, these are arguments that people are making in favor of or against legalization versus decriminalization, is how far can we push this to make this a regular industry?
Gene, did you have a follow-up?
No. I was just listening. That's like a very good question, because you know, this is a like a very demanding physical job that leaves people with, you know, physical and emotional scars from doing it. Even if this, you know, the sex, even if let's say 95% of your clients over what a 15, 20 year period are fine, mm-hmm. and you don't mind doing it, and you're one of, I mean, because people have different attitudes towards sex, right? People have different attitudes towards sex. You know, there was a statistic not so long ago, which was like, oh, 1 in 3 women have been raped or something. Yeah. I was like, damn, that's a big number. I was like, I can't believe that's a number. Then when you think about it, you know, there were just a lot of women who were like, oh, I was drunk, passed out, guy took advantage of me. I'm not actually that bothered about it. You know, some people it's like super traumatic. Some people like, it's, you know, it is what it is. That guy's a jerk. Screw him. You know, so people will have different attitudes and a different capacity, emotional capacity to like deal with this. But even 95% of your clients you're totally fine with. There's going to be a 5% over that period who have like been violent to you, who have been scary to you, who've done things that are like, you know, like that you didn't want to do and things like that. And that's going to leave emotional. And you can, you know, you can say the same for other manual jobs, like working down a mine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like working down a mine is like a physically demanding, and like that takes a huge toll on people who do that. Right. Yep. So, you know, and we recognize that in society, but we don't necessarily recognize the same thing about people who are being in the sex industry, even if they've gone into it with their eyes open and totally consensual.
The physical demands, as you say, I mean, it's
extensive. You've got STDs, you've got, you know, you've got pregnancy, you've got a lot of other issues that can come up with having sex that often and that frequently, that are really unpleasant. But, you know, also like, I think one of the things that that we haven't mentioned and is important to talk about is demand, right? I mean, we're talking about supply and, you know, how to regulate that. But the question is demand. Like, how do we get fewer people to pay for sex? And that's something that I think doesn't come up in the conversation enough. You know, if there were laws that were just busting the men and not busting the women, I mean, in a scenario in which a man is paying a woman for sex, right? We would probably see slightly different outcomes. But in a lot of these cases, the women are the ones who get picked up and fined. The men are just told, get out of here, go home, right? Especially a foreign tourist, especially a white tourist, right? They're going to have a very different treatment from the police than the Thai or Cambodian or Laotian woman who is servicing them. And, you know, this also comes down to that fundamental conversation about, like, if men are always going to pay for sex and women are just meeting that supply, like meeting that demand, who is in trouble here? And how do we penalize? I think that's really important to think about.
Well, isn't there a model? I forget what country that is.
Yeah, where, I mean, Sweden. Sweden was the model.
The Nordic model.
Where the men are actually picked up, but the women are left alone. Yeah.
Yep. And that's a model that has worked relatively well in a lot of places. I think there's, again, there's issues with a lot of different models. And I think there have been issues that have been surfacing around that as well. But I mean, that is definitely something to consider.
Another thing to consider, Jason, is we have to give every male in the world alum, which is apparently this thing they used to put in people's tea to stop them being so horny. There used to be rumors.
Does it work though?
I have no idea. There used to be rumors that they used to put it in the tea at Baghdad University so that the students wouldn't fraternize with each other. But I mean, it's like it is a fundamental problem. It's related to, I think, it's related perhaps to a demand from men, but also to a society where there were like, we still haven't like managed to,
you know, it's
have
fun.
Like good gen, you know, like good a good role between the genders.
Which creates
this notion that men want sex and women don't want sex. No, women want sex too. It's just they might.
Oh, definitely.
You know, it's like men. It's like there's a whole, yes, but there's a whole cultural thing which says that, you know, which is like, oh, which is like the women don't want sex and they shouldn't want sex. Right?
Yeah, I mean that's a whole different.
A good
Christian woman
doesn't want it, right?
Good Christian woman doesn't want it, and that's where you get this. I mean, a lot of things that we call fetishes in sex are only fetishes because of the social conditions in which they, you know, in which we live. Like, why, you know, like, what's all this whole thing? You remember when everyone was calling everyone a cuck in 2017? You know, it was like, well, why is it we, you know, what's the fetish about having a black dude nail your white?
I don't think it has to be a black dude, Gene. I think you're pulling to racism.
I think that's what it's all about. But it was socially constructed. The same thing is about, like, weird. There are people out there who want to like have sex with women who are not like consensual, right?
Oh,
there's like sickos who don't, you know, they're real.
Oh,
sickos.
You mean like the rape fantasy stuff?
The rape fantasy. Yeah. There's like a whole load of like really.
There's
weird,
a lot of porn about that.
A lot of.
Remember the woman and the husband that I think she was the one that had the rape fantasy, and she always wanted her husband to save her, and he ended up killing a guy. They would hire male prostitutes.
No, I don't remember this. No, what?
You don't, Gene, you remember this?
No.
You think I'm making this up? This is a real story.
He killed.
I think he killed a couple people.
Oh, that's so.
So they would hire male prostitutes. Well, that's not funny to kill somebody. No. They hired male prostitutes, and he would hide in the closet, come out. They did a Law and Order about it.
A Law and Order is on point. Like, if you want to know what is going on in the world of sexual weirdness, like Law and Order SVU is on it. Yeah.
I thought it was all made up and I've came across.
No, it's ripped straight from the headlines. It's incredible. But they have like really good episodes about trafficking they also always end with hotlines and stuff to do. But like people, like a lot of information comes through on that show that people don't give it enough credit for.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened a few years ago as we talk about trafficking is that in Atlanta, there was a young man that killed a bunch of women that worked in massage parlors. I don't know if you guys remember.
Oh, I remember this. Yep.
he walked into these massage parlors and shot and
was it the it was a Asian massage,
yeah, Asian massage parlors. Yeah, I remember that. That's also why I asked the question about, is there a plan for, you know, people that age out, because that is the plan in the States for people that age out, is
to go into like massage.
Yeah, and, because those women, the thing it was kind of a turkey shoot for them because they couldn't get out, because those places weren't designed for them to have easy exits. And all of those women, I believe, that except for one that actually got hit with a stray, were much, much older.
That's horrible.
So, I mean, we have it here in the States. I mean, you don't have to go to Thailand.
No.
I just, you know.
They had it in the mall here in Springfield until somebody bust them.
Oh, someone busted a massage place in Springfield?
They had it in the mall next to the food court. And it was like, wait, what? Like, well, Springfield is like, you know, like Springfield is ridiculous because they have like, there was a newspaper article going like, the best steak in Springfield is served at Centerfolds, the strip club. And I was like, I have never seen such a propaganda campaign to find people excuses to be going to a strip club.
Right.
And it's like, it's
Parkersburg, West Virginia, the best steak.
It's like, who are you fooling? You're going to, don't pretend to your wife that you're getting a steak. You're going there to watch people take their clothes off. But, you know, the good Christian men of Springfield need a reason, you know, why they have to do that. But I mean, it's a very difficult, like, people who think that there's an easy answer to this are like missing the point, because it strikes me that like there is no easy answer to this industry. Like you said, so long as the demand exists, there'll be people willing to meet that demand and people forced into meeting that demand, because there's money to be made, and you know, that people have to commodify their bodies is, you know, the dark side of the current economic and political order that we live in. And, you know, there are jobs out there that are better and jobs that are worse. And for a lot of people, not for everybody, this is like a very dangerous job on so many levels, physical, health, emotion, and things like that. And the prohibition regimes just strikes me, they haven't worked. Right.
That would be like my takeaway from this. I agree with you. I think it's complicated. I think there are probably different models that would suit different societies better, right? Like, depending on what kind of society you're in, what your professed values are, the way that your genders interact with each other, right? There are going to be different models that work better in Sweden than they might in, you know, the UAE than they might in Ghana, right? These are all going to be different. And you have to, you know, find a model that's going to work for your society and the people in it. But I would say that the takeaway that I have is that criminalization just doesn't work. That was what came across very strongly to me. And so the question is, what can we do? What is a better model that we can come up with that will protect the women and girls, will protect children, will protect trafficking survivors and victims? How do we maximize for making sure that those people are the best off that they can be? And criminalization just does not seem to be it.
Well, on that gloomy point.
On that gloomy note, that is our cheery journalist friend here. She's always reporting.
Always here for good stories. And
Where can people find you, Neha?
Neha. So it's at Neha Whataker. So the spelling of my name up there, just at Neha Whataker on Twitter is the best way to go. But you can also visit my website, which is, again, www.nehawhataker.com.
I'll put them all in the description. So we'll be able to find the article. You'll be able to find Neha's website. And do follow her on Twitter, if Twitter still exists in the next week. Who knows?
It'll be fine. Twitter's not going anywhere.
Twitter will always be okay.
Twitter is everywhere. It's like Hasbro. It's fine.
Although Elon Musk seems to be making a real attempt to make it like not a function. I wasn't bothered when Elon Musk took over. I was like, one big business person as good as another. It's just like, no, he's like bad at doing it. He seems to be just bad at running Twitter. It's like, just make it work, dude.
You know what?
You could tweet all the nonsense you want. I don't care. I just don't want you to, like, anyway. That's enough.
I mean, is Jared Kushner going to be running it? Is that the latest? Did you see that? Yeah, no. the Kush taking over. That's a rumor, by the way. So anyone listening, that's that's hearsay. That's not fact.
I don't even know what to say to that. You know what it makes me want to do? Go talk to real people more.
Yeah.
I'll go tweet out my thoughts to real people and see what happens. thank you, Neha. Wherever you're watching or listening to this show, there are links in the description to Neha's website and the article in the Financial Times Foreign Policy. Thank you. And we are
out.